Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and co-parents of all ages, this podcast is for you. Introducing in the center ring, the amicable divorce expert, Judith Weigel.
We are back with one of my very favorite family law attorneys, Matthew Smyrda, and we're going to be talking about one of my very favorite topics, celebrity divorces. Why do I like celebrity divorces so much? Because it's an interesting prism through which to look at the same aspects that go with every single divorce, only these people have so many more Instagram followers than us. And so that's what makes it so different. But Matthew, thank you so much. I know you're eternally busy. Thank you for coming back and having this discussion.
Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure to be here and always worth making time for, Judy.
Thank you. And our audience appreciates that. So this is our second installment. On the first installment, we talked about Kim and Kanye's divorce and Dr. Dre and Nicole. And by the way, there's some updates. So let's do the updates first before we go to Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie. So the update on Kim and Kanye is they did have a prenup, and Kris Jenner would, of course, always make sure that happened. So the update on TMZ, My Bible, is that Kanye doesn't want spousal support. I'm sorry, I'm laughing about that. And I'm sure that was taken care of in the prenup, but it's custody. It's custody. So that's the real cornerstone now of their divorce is custody.
Sure.
And I think, and you can tell me more, you probably know the ins of all of these divorces, but with Kanye, I guess he lives in the Midwest, Montana, Utah, something.
It was Wyoming, maybe.
Wyoming.
Ranch, right. Yeah.
So he pretty much lives in Wyoming. Kim, of course, lives here in the Los Angeles area. And if that wasn't hard enough to have two different states that parents live in and to divide up time, we still have this issue with Kanye over emotional stuff, you know. So can you speak to, what do you do when parents live in two different states, first of all?
Sure. Well, I mean, that's one of the hardest problems to solve in any child custody dispute is distance. And I mean, it's hard enough when you have, you know, one parent who lives in Pasadena and the other one lives in Palos Verdes, you know, let alone a situation like this where you have a parent living in Calabasas and the other one in Wyoming, right? So the key difference between their case and most cases, though, is that they have resources. You know, Kanye, for example, it wouldn't be a burden for him to probably charter a private jet, get on a private jet, come to Los Angeles, and probably even have another home in the Los Angeles area that he will use for his custodial time. I'm sure he wants the kids to go to his main home in Wyoming, but you know that's going to be an objection, is the burden of travel on the children. It's not in any child's best interest to be flying halfway across the country, you know, multiple times per week. So to the extent that can be avoided, as it's you know, it's physically draining, it disrupts their school, it disrupts their extracurriculars. To the extent you can avoid that, you would have more ability and options to do so with that level of resources. But in ordinary people's cases where you have, you know, multi-state parents, so to speak, generally what happens is the court has to pick one parent who's going to have the majority of the time. And we don't really call them the primary custodial parent in California. We call them the sole custodial parent. And then the other parent who lives in the other state is going to have visitation. And the way most courts would deal with that issue, I think, and what I've seen in my experience, is there's going to be basically two different types of schedules. There's going to be when school is in session and when school is not in session. And so when school is in session, they're going to be with the sole custodial parent in that state where their primary residence is, where their school is located, and it will be really up to the other parent how often they're going to be able to come visit in the home state with the children during school time. But then when you have breaks, like in the summer and spring break and winter break, most likely all or at most of those breaks are going to belong to the other parent, the non-custodial parent. So you could expect the summertime is going to be spent with the other parent out of state. Most of the breaks will be, to the extent there are 3-day weekends or 4-day weekends, you could then possibly have a travel weekend in there. I had one case where it wasn't even out of state. It was Southern California and Northern California. The child moved with mom up to Northern California. And what the judge did there was the judge had 2 visits a month on a weekend. So from a Friday to a Sunday, one visit would be Southern California. The other visit would be Northern California. And so I guess it depends on the distance. You could do something like that for somebody who lived in Las Vegas, for example, or Arizona. But you know, if you have a situation where one parent's in LA and the other is in New York City, that's a lot of burden unless you can charter private jets.
Absolutely. And how about the situation where both parents start by living in the same city, but then for work purposes or some other reason, one of the parents needs to move to another state, and that parent is the one that they already looked at as maybe having more custodial time. How do you handle, I guess, how do you handle the visitation schedule? And then I want to move into child support in both cases.
Sure. Great questions. And, you know, it's somewhat complex legally because there are 2 different sets of standards or tests, so to speak, that apply depending on whether there is a joint physical custody arrangement before the move or if there is one parent with sole physical custody. That's like a threshold question, basically. So whichever the answer is, that's going to dictate the framework of the analysis by the court if the parents can't come to an agreement. So, and again, I'm really watering this down simply. Any family law lawyers listening to this are going to probably be going nuts for how I'm going to simplify this. But essentially, if there is joint physical custody, meaning before the move, the parents have an approximately equal timeshare, and it doesn't have to be 50-50. It can just be, you know, they both have, there's significant time spent with both parents. Then the court really is going to have to do an analysis of, well, what's in the best interests of this child? And to do that, they're going to look at the whole picture, okay? On the other hand, if there is a parent who has sole physical custody here and there's a move taking place, really the presumption would be that the child would go with the sole custodial parent. So the burden really would be on the other non-custodial parent to make enough of a showing to say, hey, wait a second, even though I don't have sole physical custody right now, this move is going to impact the child so much that it makes more sense for the child to stay here with me and we'll just completely flip the custodial arrangement. So those are the 2 different standards and burdens of proof, we call them. But under either of them, there's really kind of the same stuff that the court looks at. And that's, well, let's look at the life of the child, okay? So what do we mean by that? Well, what's the status quo? What is it like? What does the child do on a given week? Who is the child with? Is the child in school? And this has gotten a lot more complicated in the pandemic where kids are quote-unquote in school as long as they have an internet connection. You know, you could have kids attending school, quote-unquote, in Beverly Hills. One is sitting in a penthouse in New York City. The other is sitting in a mansion in the Bahamas. And the other is at the Four Seasons Maui, and they're all attending school in Beverly Hills.
Okay, I want to be one of those children, by the way, that you just described.
But, you know, in ordinary, and the way things are going now, you know, with the pandemic getting much better and rates going down, kids are going back to school, I don't think that's going to be as much of an issue going forward. But you'd look at the school, you'd look at extracurriculars, you would look at where the contacts, the close contacts of the children are. So, you know, family members, aunts, uncles, grandparents, even just close family friends, godparents, you know, their friends, the children's friends, their friend group, where their pediatrician has been, the pediatrician's been seeing them, their pediatric dentist. If they have a therapist, you know, are they going to lose out on treatment from all these people that have history, is that going to be part of an impact of the move? So that's the whole picture that gets looked at. And almost always it's done by a child custody evaluator. And a child custody evaluator would either be appointed by the court or by agreement of the parties to kind of study this, figure all this out, and render an opinion as to what's really in the best interest of the child or what's going to happen. So it's not, it'd be very rare that the court would just take testimony from both parents on this. They would hear from the parents, they would take testimony, but they really would put a lot of weight into what that evaluator, who is supposed to be an expert and is supposed to be neutral, comes up with.
Where does moving jurisdiction and registering that with the court come in if there's a move away with the children out of state?
Well, I think what you're saying is essentially which court would be dealing with it, meaning if...
Well, if you have young children, you have quite a ways to still co-parent while they're still minors.
Yeah.
And we'll use the example, you start out in Los Angeles County where we are, and then mom needs to move to another state more than an hour plane ride away.
Sure.
Well, it doesn't even matter if how far it is. It's just in another state.
Yeah.
So is there a change in the court that has to oversee anything that may come up, or does it remain in California even though mom has moved to some other state?
Good question. Good question. So normally the California court would issue the order, and presumably they would, what's called, retain jurisdiction over the issue of child custody. So you would have to look at their order to see if there's a clause in there that says reservation of jurisdiction, which would say something like, you know, this court or the Los Angeles Superior Court or the whatever, Ventura Superior Court, whatever it is, retains jurisdiction over the issues of child custody. So they would retain jurisdiction from that moment forward. However, what really governs all of this is actually it's called the UCCJEA. It stands for Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction and Enforcement Act. And it's been adopted by, I think, almost all of the states in the United States. And it governs the analysis of which court can make orders here. Okay. So there's also different types of orders. For example, let's say the children moved to Texas. Okay. If the court needed to make some emergency orders, whatever those might be, the Texas court could do it pretty quickly because the children are there. Okay. But if there were to be a change in the custody orders, meaning a schedule change, or if there were to be a dispute about some legal custody issue, like maybe, I don't know, a dispute of whether the children participate in some religious ceremony or whether they go to a certain high school, whatever it might be, that's not an emergency issue in the truest sense of the word. So it would become a little bit unclear which court would deal with it. And you'd have to conduct an analysis under the UCCJEA to figure out, well, what is the home state? What is the home state? And again, you know, family law lawyers would be really, really irritated for how I'm going to simplify this. But general rule of thumb is you look at where the children have been for the last 6 months and if they have established 6 months residency in the new state. And so the answer to that can sway what becomes the home state under the UCCJEA.
The parent who moves to another state from the state where they got divorced, do they need to register at another court in the city they're moving to?
They don't need to, because a judgment of California is supposed to be treated with the same force and effect in any other state, Texas or wherever else. There's a thing in the Constitution called the Full Faith and Credit Clause, which allows judgments from other states to be enforced. So legally speaking, no. However, I do think it is a good idea if the parent anticipates any kind of problems involving the court to file a new case there and what's called domesticate the judgment from the other state. And each state has its own procedure for doing that. But in California, for example, you have to like get a certified copy of the judgment from the court and that issued it and provide it to the local court where you're going, that kind of thing. So it would be worthwhile if there's any anticipation of court involvement to domesticate the foreign state judgment wherever they move to, just so that's taken care of. And so you have a forum. You have a place to go if you need some kind of orders.
Okay. Child support. So when you're dealing with parents in two different states and the visitation schedule has to be the way you described it, the parent that does not have sole custody would probably have summers and, you know, those other breaks.
Right.
So how do you approach child support in a situation like that?
Well, yeah, that's a tough one, because I think what you're getting at is how do you come up with a percentage of time that each parent is spending with the children for purposes of putting that into the formula that's used to calculate child support. And that's, I mean, it's really tough. And I would say it's kind of an art, not a science. What I would do if I was faced with that fact pattern is I would literally probably print out a calendar, and I would on the calendar use color coding to analyze what the schedule is. And then I would do like a fraction type analysis. I would find out, you know, X number of days are moms, Y number of days are dads. Those two should add up to 365 days. So there's not, you know, any day in the year where they're not with the child. Then I would create a fraction of, you know, 180 out of 365 or whatever it might be. And then that fraction would lead me to the percentage. That would be a prospective calculation before the move happened. So presumably you'd be establishing and figuring out child support at the same time as the decision is made. But then from there, maybe a year or two down the line, once there's been time, you actually kind of do the reverse. It would depend on which side of the fight you're on, the person who wants more support or less. But you'd probably look at it and say, okay, well, we already have the number that the order says. Let's go back and look back 12 months, 24 months at what actually happened, who actually exercised their time. For example, you know, let's say dad were to get spring break, but dad decided not to exercise spring break. Well, mom's going to want the child custody percentage to adjust so that spring break's not included because dad didn't take it, you know? So you would have to make that presentation. That's not a given though. That's up to the court how they want to do it. And so if you were trying to go down that road, this is why I recommend to parents to keep a child custody log. And I know it's a tedious task, but what I mean by that is have some kind of a calendar, whether it's an app or a physical notebook or however you like to calendar things. Track each day of who's with the children and who's doing what, who takes them to the pediatrician, who takes them to soccer practice, who takes them to family members' celebrations. You know, who goes to parent-teacher conferences, who goes to back-to-school night. All of that stuff should be documented so that you have this log that you could go back and figure out that status quo pretty easily.
And the poor kids. You know, this is really interesting when we have these discussions about the formalities of all of this. And, you know, Matthew, I always go to the kids. What's this life like for the children, this back and forth, this craziness? I can't imagine.
It's hard.
I guess it is.
It's really hard. But I mean, what can you do?
I know.
But, you know, life happens. And like you said, people, a lot of times what I find causes this are three things. Number one, you have family in another state. So, you know, maybe for example, you came to California because you married someone who worked in the entertainment industry, but your family is back in Georgia or something, right? I mean, you have no reason to stay now in California, so you want to move back. That's really a common one. Number two is job. When people have to take a new job somewhere else, that's just, you know, it just is what it is. You have to pay the bills, right? But the third is neither of those. It's when one of the parents moves on and is dating or engaged to someone new, and that person wants to move for whatever reason, for their job or for their family or whatever it is. And that's the real reason for the move. New girlfriend, new boyfriend. Yeah.
That's I can imagine that's the toughest of all. Yeah. Okay, so that's Kim and Kanye. Let's go to Dr. Dre and Nicole. There is a lot happening with them. All right. So first thing is, who's got the prenup? So when we last talked, the prenup was completely missing. I believe it's still missing. what do you... So, so I, TMZ, the Bible, one article was talking about they want to have a trial, a five-day trial over the prenup. How do you have a trial over the prenup? Tell me what's going on.
Well, let's separate the two issues, because if no one can furnish a copy of the prenup, then, I mean, there's really no prenup. I mean, I suppose if – and again, we don't know. We probably won't know this level of detail, but maybe there are drafts that they have, but they just can't find the signed copy. So maybe there are some documents out there, but they're just not the executed copy, in which case I suppose you could have a trial as to, you know, oh yeah, that's the one we signed, oh this and that. But it's going to be pretty hard to convince the judge and meet your burden of proof to say, hey, even though I don't have a signed agreement, there is a signed agreement. Particularly when you should assume that there were multiple copies of this, and if everyone's lost the copies, and if the other person says, yeah, well, we were negotiating a prenup, and yeah, there was 12 drafts, and it got crazy, and I told him I wasn't going to marry him, and then so he said, forget it, and we got married, and nobody signed it. And that's why there's no signed copy. I mean, well, without a signed copy, that's a tough one to sell. Now, there's probably evidence of them abiding by the prenup and doing things according to the prenup even after it was quote-unquote signed, so there'd be a counter to that. But I think that's a really tough fight. If somebody were to come to me with that fact pattern, I would say you have very minimal chances of getting a prenup upheld if you don't have a signed copy of it.
And then who remembers what's in their prenup? I mean, my position has always been with contracts. Contracts are not an issue of honesty. Because if somebody wants to break a contract, they're going to break it. Yeah. Contracts are an issue of memory. Who remembers everything innocently years down the road? And these two people were pretty young. I mean, I did watch Straight Outta Compton like 100,000 times. So I know that Dre was beginning his success, but he was still a very young man when they got married and had children. I mean, my question is, do you even think of a prenup at that age and without making millions of dollars yet?
Well, I mean, it just depends on who's advising you, I think, because I doubt that, you know, especially artists, they generally don't think from the business side of things. They're so talented and skilled with creating and envisioning things. That's where their focus is. It's usually they're not focusing on the business side of it. But, you know, young artists like that, young musicians, actors, creative people, a lot of times the cause of them getting a prenup is either their parent, their entertainment lawyer who they work with to do their dealings, or their accountant, their business manager. Those are the folks that they're, you know, their advisors, the ones that kind of steer them in certain directions. And they may say, hey, you know, it wouldn't hurt you to get a prenup. You know, I mean, I've done prenups for a number of musicians that are not, you know, they're not at Dr. Dre's level, and, you know, are successful, but not making millions of dollars.
Well, and Dr. Dre wasn't at Dr. Dre's level way back in the day. Go ahead.
Right. Well, and, you know, it's just a good idea. You know, if you have the potential to earn a lot of money, it makes sense to get a prenup. And
that's true. He probably knew because, NWA really hit it big. And so he probably had the vision that knowing who he was, he would probably have a successful career of some level.
Sure.
Probably.
Sure.
Oh, but you know what? Here, I'm reading. As we reported, TMZ article says, Nicole signed the prenup before they married, but claims Dre came to her shortly after the wedding, saying he regretted pressuring her to sign it and tore up multiple copies right in front of her. Dre denies he pressured her and denies he ever tore it up and points to a clause in the document. See, this is, goes back to what you said. Points to a clause in the document that says altering it must be in writing. Okay, so maybe what you're saying is true. Maybe there are unsigned copies.
Yeah, that could be. And, you know, it makes sense given that it was signed so long ago in the pre-digital era. You know, now we would just have a PDF copy and that would be pretty easy to track down, but there were no PDFs presumably when they signed it. And that's why you're not being able to find it. If there's an admission by her that she signed it, not that she did it voluntarily or there was duress or whatever, but just if she says, yeah, I signed that document, even though you don't have a signature, that would be an admission that I think would fix the problem. And so if she admits she signed it, then now you're getting into the enforceability of it, which is why you would have to have what's called a bifurcated trial. And that's what they're asking for in that case. There's I don't know if there's a motion for bifurcation or a proposal to bifurcate. It doesn't really matter. What it means is you can't have a trial on the financial issues of your divorce until you figure out the rules of engagement, so to speak. And the rules of engagement normally, if there wasn't a prenup, would just be as set forth in the California Family Code and in case law. But when you sign a prenup, the prenup replaces that and becomes its own rules of engagement. There's somebody who I heard said, and I think she said it really well, I can't remember who it was, another family law attorney. She says, everyone has a prenup. Everyone has a prenup. Your prenup is the rules that the state of California has come up for you. They drafted your prenup.
That's interesting.
So you can either have their prenup that they prescribed for you, or you can create your own prenup. And so if you create your own prenup, those become the rules of engagement. Those replace the regular law. So that goes to bifurcation because you can't, for example, figure out if something is separate property or community property without knowing which set of rules you're going to be applying. Choice A, the prenup, choice B, the law as it is. So what you do is before you have the trial on those financial issues, you just have a trial on essentially whether this prenup is valid and enforceable. And then in that trial, that's where those arguments come up because the law does have a set of things that can happen. These are called legal arguments or grounds for setting aside a prenuptial agreement that are prescribed by case law and by statute. Funny enough, I know a lot about this because the law as it exists right now on prenuptial agreements was the result of a very famous case. It was a case involving a baseball player named Barry Bonds.
One of the most famous. Your firm worked on that.
Correct.
That's when I met you.
Correct.
Okay, please
Correct.
Keep going.
Before, now, I'll preface this with I wasn't there when that case was going on. That case was going on, I think, over 10 years before I joined the firm. But, you know, my mentors, the guys who taught me how to do this, who took me on board, they were the guys who represented Barry Bonds from the trial court level all the way through the California Supreme Court and resulted in a victory at the highest level, which then resulted in legislation that was passed by the state legislature in response to the Bonds decision. They call it anti-Bonds statutes, which are what currently exists in the family code right now. And so in the family code, there are a number of things that you can cite or claim that would be grounds for setting aside a prenuptial agreement. And so what I tell my clients is when we're litigating a prenup, think of it literally like taking a plate of spaghetti and meatballs and just throwing it at the wall, boom, and just hoping something sticks to the wall. And that metaphor is you just try and argue all of those defenses and hopefully one of them stays and that breaks the prenup, you know? And so that's why you're seeing things like, oh, I felt pressured. We call that duress, right? I was coerced into signing it. There were misrepresentations. I didn't get enough disclosure. You know, somebody threatened me. He put a gun to my head. And here's some other unique stuff. So there's certain factors of duress in the premarital context. We look at things like, well, were the wedding invitations out? Did anybody put money down for deposits? What's the proximity of when it was signed to the wedding date? How many drafts were there? Was it a carefully bargained for agreement? When was the draft signed? There's a 7-day cooling off period in California that is supposed to happen. There are exceptions to it. And when people have lawyers, you can technically waive it, but good rule of thumb is you just abide by it to make sure your agreement is above board. And what that means is the final draft of the agreement has to be done and presented to both parties at least 7 calendar days before they sign it. So when you think about it, that means you have to have the final draft done at least a week before the wedding, and you have to sign it before the wedding happens. So maybe that was complied with or not, but that's probably irrelevant because that wasn't in place in the 90s when this was signed. So one other interesting thing too is this, this trial will actually be done under the pre-bonds law because it's going to be the law that was in place at the time the contract was signed.
Okay.
That's so, a lot. I'm sorry.
No. This is all phenomenal. This is all phenomenal. And of course, Bonds is a celebrity. It fits our discussion.
There you go. That's right.
So,
and a really nice man, by the way. I did get to meet him. And as a Dodger fan my whole life, I had booed him many, many times vocally because he was just hitting too many home runs against the Dodgers over the years. And I never liked the man until I actually met him in person. One of the nicest guys you could ever meet. Totally different than his public persona and the way he's portrayed by the media and everything else. Just a really nice person.
Well, you know, Jennifer Lopez, as of today, is available. She and A-Rod are no longer together. I'd let you know.
How funny.
This is my biggest news, celebrity news. Okay, I want to go back to the bifurcation thing. So we have the prenup issue. They're duking that out. But then Laura Wasser, the attorney for, I guess, Dre? Yes, Dre.
Correct.
Is requesting a bifurcation. Please explain what a bifurcation is.
Yes. So she's doing exactly what we talked about. She's just trying to say to the court, hey, we have this prenup out there, so we have to decide whether it's valid and enforceable before we can go any further on the financial issues of this case. So that's to be expected. I don't know exactly why the other side wouldn't agree to that. Typically, that's something that the lawyers stipulate to, meaning they reach an agreement saying, hey, we got to bifurcate this issue. It's very unusual that that would have to be litigated, but I can't imagine the court not bifurcating that issue. It would be a disaster at trial.
Okay. Bifurcating the divorce, meaning you get a status-only divorce, you still have to make decisions, or bifurcate the prenup?
No. So what you're thinking of is also a very common thing that people bifurcate when they want to dissolve their marital status early. That's not what I'm talking about. But the concept, it's the same. There's a certain number of issues that fall under bifurcation. And what you just mentioned, the divorce status, is one of them. So a lot of times when a divorce is going on and on, and one person wants to become legally single, they want the marital status terminated, but it's too soon to do it because there's complicated financial issues or whatever the reason might be, they can move to bifurcate status, meaning the court will just take the issue of marital status and it'll put that to the front, will terminate the marital status and hold everything else open for a later time. That's bifurcation too. Bifurcation is a term, and again, this is me really simplifying it. I think I'm going to really anger a lot of family law professionals with this podcast, but hopefully...
Yes, but the regular people listeners are going to love you.
Exactly. And, you know, I think one of the things that my clients say positively about me is I can speak like a regular person, not a lawyer, so I'm just going to do that. So my apologies, any family law attorneys listening. But bifurcation, really what it is think of your divorce as like a basket of eggs, okay? And each egg is a specific issue. So there's a child custody egg. There's a division of assets egg. There's a spousal support egg, right? Bifurcation is just reaching into the basket of eggs, grabbing the prenup egg or grabbing the marital status egg, pulling it out and putting it in front of the basket and figuring out what to do with it first before you deal with the rest of the eggs in the basket. That's bifurcation, the act of pulling an egg out. And so you can do it for certain kinds of issues, including whether a prenup is valid, whether the status should be changed, things like that.
Well, you may know truly what's going on, but the article I pulled down from TMZ, it looks like they're saying the divorce status, that Dre wants to be divorced and will deal with the division of assets later. I think that's what's going on, unless you think differently.
That could be it. I mean, there could be two separate issues being bifurcated. He could be trying to terminate his status. And the reason for that is that you would, maybe he wants to get remarried, or maybe he just wants to move forward in some respect. Maybe he just wants his marital status over.
Right, because that weighs heavy on people anyway. And, you know, if he has another relationship going, which he may, right. Who knows, I'm sure that other person would want him to be truly single.
Right.
But it doesn't really sound like that's to the advantage of Nicole, because still there are all these assets that need to be dealt with and child support and
right.
and all of that stuff. So is that really to both people's advantage to just do a status only divorce and do the assets and debts later?
Well, it can be to someone's advantage, but there are often burdens and consequences that go with a bifurcation of marital status. And for example, when you terminate your marital status, a lot of times that can affect someone's ability to have health insurance coverage.
Right.
Because they're not married anymore. So one of the conditions that the court often will put on somebody asking for bifurcation is they will have to basically be responsible for continuing to provide the other person similar or better health insurance coverage than they had with the marital status in place. So that's one example. There can be an impact on someone's rights under the probate code, their rights to inherit things, their rights to be, a beneficiary or, you know, be a designated beneficiary on a retirement plan or a pension. There's all kinds of things that can get affected. There can be tax consequences, for example, if the marital status is dissolved and then assets aren't divided for several years, that can cause too much time to pass that could affect that normally being a tax-free transfer, but now it becomes taxable. So basically, when the person who wants to bifurcate and get the status changed, they have to take on the burden of you know, basically indemnifying the other person from those adverse consequences.
Okay. And then lastly on this, is there a time limit if you get a status-only divorce? Is there a time limit on when you absolutely must deal with the division of assets and debts?
Not really, no. There's a general rule of thumb that a case needs to be dealt with within 5 years from when it's filed. But I've seen judges say, oh, well, there was a status-only judgment, so that complies with the rule. So it can keep going, but general rule would be there's a 5-year limit on a case. But I've had cases that have gone, you know, 10, 11 years. So that there's not a hard and fast time limit, no.
So if the judge grants the bifurcation, and let's just say Dre's the one who wants it. Can Nicole say, Yes, I'll agree to this, but we have to have a limit on when we have to deal with assets and debts?
No, she couldn't say that. I mean, she can't put a hard time limit on there. I mean, I suppose she could say that she wants a trial date set or a trial setting conference date to be set, but there's not going to be a limit. That's up to the judge. It's not up to the parties to put into place. But I have... I have had cases where people fight the request for bifurcation of marital status. And I have actually, I had this one case where the judge was inclined not to grant it. She was concerned by these allegations that the wife had made about fraud and non-disclosure by my former client. And the judge was convinced enough to say, hey, my inclination is not to grant bifurcation. Because there's this thing called the disentitlement doctrine, which exists in California family law, which basically says, and again, here's one of those things that family law attorneys are going to get mad at me for, but the disentitlement doctrine basically says if someone's not complying with court orders or their obligations, their fiduciary duties, they shouldn't be allowed. They should be disentitled from then invoking the court's help on other issues that they want. So for example, somebody who's not, you know, not paying support maybe, not paying court-ordered child support or spousal support, shouldn't be able to come in and get status bifurcated. That's one argument, right? And the issue wasn't resolved while I was on the case, so I can't tell you how it came out, but I had a judge who was inclined not to do that. And I have seen instances where, you know, I've had to object to a bifurcation of status knowing I was going to lose, but my client was just so, she was still in love with the guy, and she says, I have to do everything in my power to stop this. And I said, no, it's going to happen, and it happened, you know. But where we most commonly see bifurcations of status are when somebody wants to get remarried, or if they have a serious health condition and they want to terminate the marital status as soon as possible, which isn't ideal, but at least would, in theory, allow the family law court to reserve jurisdiction over the property issues instead of it just going to the probate court if they were to die. Even though it still can go to the probate court, it just kind of helps them keep it in the family law court if there was a bifurcation.
Ergo why I don't do bifurcations. I always refer attorneys when somebody says, sure, I can't take it anymore. Can't we just be divorced and we'll deal with this stuff later? Not with me, but let me refer you to Matthew Smyrna. Okay, we're going to put Dre and Nicole to bed right now. We're going to move on to Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie. I find this interesting. It's not an enormous number of issues attached with this, but there are two very interesting issues. One is supposedly, again, TMZ, I'm quoting, they didn't have a prenup. Now, they weren't kids when they got married, but they both had prosperous, successful careers. Wonder why they didn't get a prenup.
No idea. Makes no sense whatsoever. And, you know, they were both very much A-list stars. And so they had, presumably at the time, the best of agents, accountants, lawyers, who I'm sure all, I'd be floored to learn that any of those folks would not recommend a prenup. I'm sure they were. I'm sure they were saying, you got to get a prenup. Particularly because of how the two of them also did business together. You know, I think they started a production company and produced a number of big, high grossing films together. You would think you would want a plan for how all of that's going to be dealt with, but you never know. I mean, maybe there was talk of it and it became a stressor, and the two of them, you know, being creative types, just said, hey, screw it. We're in love. We're not getting divorced. We don't have to worry about this. It's never going to happen. So they just decided not to. Who knows?
Right. Pardon me?
It's odd. Very odd.
It really is odd, but so it goes. Now, the other fascinating part of this is the custody arrangement. So I don't believe, and you can correct me if you know differently, I don't believe they had any natural born children. There are, I believe, six children.
I think they did.
They did have natural?
At least one, yeah. I think they had at least one.
Okay.
But they also adopted a lot too.
So I think, didn't she have some children before she met Brad? Adopted, not natural, and then they adopted, because we have different cultures, different races among the six children. So like Mia Farrow, I mean, I really consider these women great women for adopting children of all different cultures and backgrounds. That, of course, to me, is a heart of gold.
Yeah.
But now we are getting divorced. So they did have, they went to court for a custody arrangement, but not regular family court. So what type of court did they go to?
Yeah, so what it sounds like what happened was there were allegations of abuse or neglect or dangerous behavior affecting the welfare of the children, serious enough to warrant DCFS, the Department of Children and Family Services. Oftentimes people call them CPS, Child Protective Services, DCFS, use whatever abbreviation you want. It's the arm of the government, the child services, that would come in and investigate. And they'll investigate anybody. They'll investigate, you know, average people or celebrities. They can investigate any family that lives in their jurisdiction. And so they presumably came in and they did an investigation, and they decided that whatever they were seeing or learning or hearing or whatever they found in their investigation, it was serious enough to actually transfer the issues of child custody away from the normal family law court and transfer them to what's called the dependency court or the juvenile court or the children's court, a court that only deals with these kind of situations pertaining to children and really is the court that makes the decision of whether children would be removed from their parents' custody and placed into, you know, either some kind of other guardian's care or even foster care. So they ended up there, it sounds like, and they have resources. And so their resources, I believe, allowed them to bring in a child custody evaluator.
Bingo, and absolutely.
That child custody evaluator, and again, we don't know for sure because these are not likely public proceedings. I'm sure these are closed door proceedings. That person, that evaluator, was probably appointed as an expert of the court under this section of the evidence code, and they would be doing the evaluation similar to what we talked about earlier if there was a move away or something like that, and they would be rendering their opinion on what to do.
So yes, there was a child custody evaluator. Now, this brings up another question for me, and that is, when you're getting divorced, and there are either children from a previous marriage that one of the two parents brings into the marriage, or, and I think in the case of Angelina, I think she adopted maybe one or two children before Brad. Where do these children fall within the responsibility of Brad, our example being the dad who and husband that's been raising them?
Well, I think it first depends on whether he ended up adopting any of the children as well. Because if he adopted the children, he'll be treated as, you know, an equal parent. There's no question there. If he didn't, then he would be treated as a step-parent, and he would still have the rights that step-parents have under the California Family Code, which I know is something you and I had talked about in a prior episode we did together. And that's, I mean, that's a whole complicated area, but, you know, step-parents do have rights that can ensure them the ability to spend time with their stepchildren, possibly to make decisions about the stepchildren, although that's a bit harder to pull off without having the adoption, but it's possible. The way the law is now, the court has the ability to truly look into the family dynamic and really try and get a sense of how involved the step parent might be or have been, and that can be in the children's best interest for them to stay involved in whatever capacity is appropriate.
So what if Angelina adopted children from different countries where there are no fathers? It's just her as the standalone parent. Then she gets married to Brad. Now they're getting divorced. Would that automatically put Brad as the responsible dad in any type of support or parental governance aspect?
Well, you'd have to, again, look and see if he adopted them. So I think you're assuming that he never adopted them as well.
Let's just say he didn't.
If he did not, then not necessarily. No, he wouldn't necessarily. There are authorities that would allow for support to come into play, but automatically in the same sense that a biological father would be responsible, no. She would have to take steps through the court to establish that.
What if he wants to take care of all of them, even the ones that he didn't adopt, but she doesn't want him to, but he's been raising them? How does that work?
That's a tough one. You'd have to get a court order on that, and you'd have to show real history of involvement and financial contribution. The court can do it if there ever was an agreement between the two parents in any capacity requiring him to support the child or children. But without that, it would be really discretionary. I mean, I would imagine a judge would be inclined to do so and would really kind of press as to why are you not allowing him to financially contribute to these children. That's just an odd position. You know, normally it's the opposite. Normally the fathers are doing everything they can not to pay child support. So, you know.
And then what if the kids want to be with dad? Let's just say he didn't adopt a couple children, but they want to be with him. What if she doesn't? I know I'm making hypothetical. This isn't really what these articles are talking about, but they just pose an interesting situation. So what if the kids want to be with Brad, dad? And mom says, you know, I don't think so.
Well, it depends on their age is one thing, because under California law, the door opens, so to speak, for the court to listen to child's preference starting at age 14. But that's not mandatory. It's up to the judge. It's just the door opens. The judge can consider it. Now, before the age of 14, the child's preference can still come into play, but it would be articulated through a child custody evaluator, not through the children themselves.
Okay. Matthew, so many more celebrities, so many more issues, but our time has come to an end today. I really do thank you. I learn so much from you every day that we do business together, and certainly on these interviews. So thank you for taking time out. And as always, celebrity or non-celebrity, how do people get in touch with you?
They can go to my website, smurdalaw.com, smurdalaw.com.
Thank you. And thank all of you for listening. You can get in touch with me through my email, Judith@theamicabledivorceexpert.com. Please share this episode with your friends. Please subscribe. And as always, have an amicable day.
That's our show for today. Thank you for joining us. Be good to yourselves, be kind to your spouse, and cherish your children above all else.